Thank you very much. Whoops. Thank you very much for inviting me. And I would just like to open with a brief apology. I've come down with a head cold, so I will be intermittently interrupting this talk to drink water and cough. Good morning, and thanks for inviting me to speak at Usenix Security. Unlike you, I'm not a security professional. However, we probably share a common human trait, namely, none of us enjoy looking like a fool in front of a large audience. I therefore chose the title of my talk to minimize the risk of ridicule. If we should meet up in 2061, much less in the 26th century, you're welcome to rib me about this talk, because I'll be happy to still be alive. So what follows should be seen as a farrago of speculation by a guy who earns his living telling entertaining lies for money. The question I'm going to spin entertaining lies around is this. What is network security going to be about once we get past the current sigmoid curve of accelerating progress and into a steady state when Moore's first law has long since burned out? And network computing appliances have been around for about as long as steam engines. I'd like to start with a few basic assumptions about the future, some implicit and some explicit, if only to narrow the field, because the future is a very broad canvas. For starters, it's not impossible we'll render ourselves extinct as a species through warfare, be wiped out by a gamma ray burster or some other cosmological sick joke, or experience the economic equivalent of a kernel panic, an unrecoverable global error in our technosphere. Any of these could happen at some point in the next 5.5 centuries. Survival is not assured. However, I'm going to spend the next half hour to hour pretending that this isn't going to happen. Otherwise, there's nothing much for me to talk about here. On to slightly less depressing things that I'm going to rule out. The idea of an artificial intelligence singularity has become common currency in science fiction over the past 2 decades. That we will create human equivalent general artificial intelligences, and they will proceed to bootstrap themselves to ever higher levels of nerdish godhood, and either keep us as pets or turn us into brightly coloured machine parts. I'm going to palm this card because it's not immediately obvious that I can say anything useful about a civilization run by beings vastly more intelligent than us. I'd be like an Australopithecine trying to visualize daytime cable TV. More of a point, the whole idea of artificial general intelligence strikes me as being about as questionable as 19th century fantasies about building steam-powered tin men. I do expect us to develop eerily purposeful software agents over the next decades, tools that can accomplish human-like behavioural patterns better than most humans can. But all that's going to happen is that those behaviours are going to be reclassified as basically unintelligent, like playing chess or Jeopardy or driving cars. In addition to all this Grinchdom, I'm going to ignore a whole grab bag of toys from science fiction's toolbox. It may be fun in fiction, but if you start trying to visualize a coherent future that includes aliens, telepathy, faster than light travel, or time machines, your futurology is rapidly going to run off the road and go crashing around the blank bits of a map that say, here be dragons. It's not constructive. You can't look for ways to harden systems against threats and attacks that emerge from the existence of leprechauns or Martians or invisible pink unicorns. So no Hollywood movie scenarios need apply. So after saying all that, I'm going to cheerfully predict that at least one barkingly implausible innovation will come along between now and 2061 and turn everything we do upside down. Just as the internet has pretty much invalidated any survey of the future of computer security that might have been carried out in 1961. So, what do I expect the world of 2061 to look like? I'm going to explicitly assume that we manage to muddle through our current energy crises, retooling for a carbon-neutral economy based on a mixture of power sources. My crystal ball is currently predicting that baseload electricity will come from a mix of fission reactors and predictable renewables such as tidal and hydroelectric power. Meanwhile, intermittent renewables such as solar and wind power will be hooked to batteries for load smoothing, used to power off-grid locations such as much of a current developing world, and possibly used on a large scale to produce storable fuels, hydrocarbons via Fischer-Tropsch synthesis or hydrogen gas via electrolysis. The reason I emphasise sort of basics as power is without electricity we don't have much of a network to worry about securing. We are, I think, going to have molecular nanotechnology and atomic scale integrated circuits. This doesn't mean magic nanite pixie dust a la Star Trek. It means, at a minimum, what today we'd consider to be exotic structural materials. It also means engineered solutions that work a bit like biological systems, but much more efficiently and controllably, and under a much wider range of temperatures and conditions and pressures. Mature nanotechnology is going to resemble organic life forms the way a Boeing 737 resembles 30 tons of seagulls. Both the Boeing and the flock of seagulls can fly, and both of them need a supply of organic fuel to oxidize in order to do so. But a flock of 30 tons of seagulls can't carry 100 passengers across the Atlantic, and Boeings don't lay eggs. Design nanosystems don't need to be general purpose replicators. So what we're going to see is basically much more efficient ways of doing stuff, but it's not necessarily going to be as lifelike as some people think. Now, where I'm going to stick my neck out in this prognostication about the future, for which you may come and mock me in 50 years' time, is that I predict great things for medicine and biology over the next century. At the beginning of this, I said that if we're still alive, you could mock me. I'm actually agnostic about the possibility that some of us may be around in 50 or 500 years' time. There are a bunch of major medical obstacles to smash flat before that becomes possible, but we're living through the early days of a revolution in genomics and biology, one made possible by massively parallel number crunching and networking. We're now beginning to work out just how complex our intracellular machinery is, and to perceive the depths of our own ignorance, which is usually the first step on the road to wisdom. Whole new areas of cellular biology have opened up in just the past decade. RNA interference as a mechanism for modulating gene expression, for example, or how the topology of chromosomal folding affects genetics. A bunch of stuff that wasn't even on the horizon in 2001. The long-term benefits of getting a handle on this stuff are going to be huge, although hard to perceive obviously at this range. We haven't yet managed to raise the upper limit on human life expectancy. It's currently around 120 years, but an increasing number of us are going to live long enough to get close to it. I think it's quite likely that within another century, the mechanisms underlying cellular senescence will be understood and treatable like other inborn errors of metabolism. In this case, ones that aren't weeded out by natural selection because they don't impact an organism's survival fitness until it's already long since past reproductive age. Now, this incidentally leads me to another prediction, something outwardly resembling the forms of democracy virtually everywhere while not actually being democracy as we know it today. Since 1911, democratic government by a republic has gone from being an eccentric minority practice to the default system of government worldwide. There are now more democracies than any other system, and even authoritarian tyrannies find it expedient to at least imitate the outward symbolism of democratic forms via rigged elections and life presidencies. As the collapse of the Warsaw Pact and then the Arab Spring demonstrated, popular support for democracy and freedom of speech isn't exceptional. It exists and is expressed everywhere when it is not actively repressed. Democracy is, however, a lousy form of government in some respects. It's particularly bad at long-term planning, for no event that lies beyond the electoral event horizon can compel a politician to pay attention to it. It does, however, have two big benefits. It handles transfers of power peacefully and provides a pressure relief valve for internal social dissent. If enough people get angry, they can vote the bums out, the bums will go. You don't need to hold a civil war, as, for example, in Syria currently. Let me focus a bit on the problems of democracy. In general, democratically elected politicians are forced to focus on short-term solutions to long-term problems because their performance is evaluated by elections held on a timescale measured in single-digit years. If a project doesn't come to fruition within their time in office, it's less than useful to them. Democratic systems are prone to capture by special interest groups, but exploit the information asymmetry that's endemic in complex societies, or by disciplined radical parties that simply refuse to negotiate. The adversarial two-party model is a very bad tool for generating consensus on how to tackle difficult or intractable problems with no precedents, such as responses to climate instability or resource shortages or new communications media. Finally, representative democracy scales up quite badly on the larger scales. Those of national governments with populations of tens to hundreds of millions, in these situations, it tends to produce voter apathy and alienation from the process of government, a pervasive sense that voting doesn't change anything, because individual voters are so distant from their representatives they wouldn't know them if they saw them in an identity parade. Questionable e-voting technologies with poor anonymization or broken audit capabilities don't help either, of course. Nor are governments in the near future going to be as important as they used to be. National governments are constrained these days by external treaties. By some estimates, about two-thirds of primary legislation in the UK, in Great Britain, has its origins in European Union directives or in World Trade Organization or World Intellectual Property Organization treaties. Even the US government, the largest superpower on the block right now, is tightly constrained by the international trade system it sponsored in the wake of the Second World War. Ultimately, a lot of the decision-making power of government in the 21st century is pushed down a level to civil service committees and special interest groups. And so we have democratic forms of government without the transparency or accountability, at least until we invent something better, which I sincerely hope will happen because it's going to be an urgent priority before the end of the century if our civilization continues to become increasingly complex as it has done for the past 50 years. Finally, in this sort of somewhat boring run-up to tackling the future of information security, I want to tackle economic development, because that's one of the key determinants of the shape of the world we're going to live in. Having asserted, yeah, you can point and mock later, that we're going to solve the energy crises, continue to burn non-fossil fuel for transport, and get better materials and medical treatments, we need to look at the shape of our civilization. Here in San Francisco, it probably sometimes seems like the United States is the center of the world. In a very real sense, it was within living memory. In 1945, about 60% of global GDP came out of this nation because the rest of the developing world had succeeded in pounding itself flat. Today, the United States, with around 5% of the planet's population, is still responsible for around 25% of planetary GDP. So, going from 60% to 25% may seem like a decline, but it isn't. It's not an absolute decline. The USA today is richer than it was in 1945. Rather, the rest of the world has been playing catch-up. Something similar happened in the 19th century. In 1860, the United Kingdom, cradle of the Industrial Revolution, occupied about the same position relative to the rest of the world that the USA occupied in 1945. Today, the UK is down to 3.5% of planetary GDP, albeit with less than 1% of the population. The good news is we're a lot richer than our ancestors. Relative decline isn't tragic in a positive-sum world, and even when the rest of the world is caught up with the United States, it will not necessarily feel poverty-stricken or poor or unpleasant to live in the United States. I'm not telling you anything new if I mention the big story of the period from 1985 to 2015 is the development of China and India. Both nations combined account for 2.5 billion people. That's just absolutely gigantic and rather hard to apprehend. To put it in perspective, that's more than four times the United States of America and the European Union combined. And those countries are sustaining economic growth at close to 10% per annum, compounded over periods of decades. Assuming they survive the obstacles on the road to development, which are not trivial, this process is going to end fairly predictably. Both India and China will eventually converge with a developed world standard of living while undergoing the demographic transition to stable or slowly declining populations that appears to be an inevitable correlate of development. The population time bomb that mesmerised futurologists in the 1970s has, happily, fizzled. We're still living in a crowded world, but every decade when the UN release revised predictions of human population over the next century, they're revised downwards. A less noticed phenomena, however, is that of Africa's development. Africa is a huge continent, home to around 1 billion people in 53 nations. Africa entered the 1980s in dismal shape. Even today, 34 of those 53 nations are ranked among the UN's list of least developed countries. However, there's a quiet economic revolution sweeping Africa. During the past decade, overall economic growth averaged more than 5% per annum. Some areas are experiencing growth in the 6 to 7% range routinely. Africa in 2011 is still poor, but it's like the poverty of the 1860s rather than the 1660s. The short-term prognosis for Africa as a continent is good, and my guess is that barring unexpected setbacks such as an even larger war than the Congo conflict, Africa will follow China and India up the development ramp before 2040. In 2006, for the first time, more than half the planet's human population lived in cities. By 2061, well over half of the planet's population will live in cities, and they will be living in conditions that correspond to the middle-class citizens of developed nations today. We're used to thinking of our world as being divided into economic zones, for developed nations, primarily urban and relatively wealthy, surmounting an immense pool of misery and medieval rural deprivation in the Third World. But by 2061, assuming we're not dead, we or our children are going to be living on an urban middle-class planet with a globalized economic and financial infrastructure recognizably descended from today's system, and governments would at least try to pay lip service to democratic norms. And there finishes the introduction to what I'm really here to talk about. This is Usenix Security, and I'm about 15 minutes into my talk, and I haven't even mentioned computers or networks yet. You're probably getting bored or irritated by now, and it's too early for an after-lunch nap, and I'm far too low-tech to give you hypnosis by PowerPoint. So let me get to the meat and drink of the stuff you came to hear about. I'd just like to add, before I go there, that the picture I just painted of a world circa 2061, which is to say the starting point from which the world of 2561 will evolve, is bunk. It's a normative projection, as an if-this-goes-on kind of future, based on the assumption that lots of stuff won't happen. No Fourth World War, no alien invasion, no AI singularity, no rapture of the nerds, no singularity of the Baptists. In actual fact, I'm pretty certain that something utterly unexpected will come along and upend all these projections. Something as weird as the World Wide Web would have looked in 1961. Even if no such black swans take wing, the world of 2061 is still going to be really odd, because the pervasive spread of network technologies that we've witnessed over the past half century is only the beginning. And while the outer forms of that comfortable middle-class, urban, developed world planetary experience theme park might look familiar to us, the internal architecture is going to be very different. Let me start with an analogy. Let's imagine that circa 1961, 50 years ago, a budding Nikola Tesla or Bill Packard somewhere in big city USA is tinkering in his garage and succeeds in building a time machine. Being adventurous, but not too adventurous, he sets the controls for 50 years in the future and arrives in downtown San Francisco today. What will he see and how will he interpret it? Well, a lot of the buildings are actually going to be familiar. Those that aren't, much of the skyline, will at least look like a the city of the future, so familiar to us from magazines of the 1930s or the 1960s. Nobody from 1961 is going to be surprised if San Francisco in 2011 has a few extra skyscrapers. Automobiles are automobiles, even if the ones he sees look kind of melted. And an obsession with aerodynamics might be taken for just another fashion fad. The 10 million lines of code and multiple microprocessors within the average 2011 car are, of course, invisible. Fashion? Hats are out, clothing has mutated in strange directions, but that's to be expected. He may be slightly frown, but the number of pedestrians walking around with wires in their ears, or holding these cigarette-sized boxes with glowing screens. But earphones weren't unheard of in 1961, and pocket television sets were one of the routine signs that you're in the future now, as far back as Dick Tracy. But he's going to be really freaked by the awful lot of mad people walking around with bits of plastic clipped to their ears, talking to their invisible friends. And why do all the advertising posters have a line of alphabet soup ending in .com on them? The outward shape of the future contains the present and the past embedded within it like flies in amber. Our visitor from 1961 is familiar with cars and clothes and buildings. After all, they all existed in his own time. But he hasn't heard of packet-switched networks and thinks of computers as mainframes trapped in air-conditioned rooms. And if he's even aware of hypertext as a concept, it's in the form Vannevar Bush described in his essay, How We May Think, published in The Atlantic in 1945, and relying on microfilm. Cellular radio networks lay in his future in 1961. The 1961 iteration of mobile telephony was the MTS network, which was entirely operator-assisted and ran over a bunch of about 25 analog VHF frequencies. Licklider's paper proposing a packet-switched network to allow general communications among computer users wasn't published until 1962. And while Jack Kilby's first working example of an integrated circuit was demonstrated in the fall of 1958, the first IC-based computers didn't come along until the 1960s. So our time traveller from 1961 has a steep learning curve if he wants to understand the technology that folks with the cordless headsets are using. And as for the social consequences of the technologies in question, beyond lots of people wandering the streets holding conversations with imaginary friends, that's an even longer reach. The social consequences of any new technology are almost always impossible or very difficult to guess in advance. I started with our time traveller being weirded out by mobile phones, and I'm going to stick with mobile phones as an example. Trivially, mobile phones let people talk to one another. What is less obvious is that for the first time, the telephone network connects people, not places. It's possible for new social behaviours to emerge. For example, people who are wandering a city's streets can contact one another and decide to meet at a coffee shop, even if neither of them is near a fixed landline for which the other has a phone number. That example might strike you as trivial, but it represents an immense behavioural shift, and as late as the early 2000s, I was hearing people, mostly in this country, saying, yeah, but I don't need a mobile phone. What would I use it for? Add in text messaging and GPS and mobile internet access, and yet more behavioural shifts are possible. The current riots in London and elsewhere in the UK appear to be coordinated by BlackBerry Messenger broadcasts and text messaging, as looters exchange information about promising locations that are unprotected by the police. And the behavioural consequence of mobile phone networks go right off the map once we add a mature LTE or WiMAX network, and once the telcos have been bludgeoned into providing plumbing rather than trying to rent you the dishwasher and the kitchen taps. We're currently, as an example of one of the strange side effects of smartphones, raising the first generation of kids who won't understand what it means to be lost. Everywhere they go, they have GPS service and a moving map that will helpfully show them how to get wherever they want to go. It's not hard to envisage an app that goes a step beyond Google Maps on your smartphone, whereby it not only shows you how to get from point A to point B, but can book transport to get you there by taxi, rideshare, or plane, within your budgetary or other constraints. That's not even far-fetched. It's just an extension of what you get when you type a mutant offspring of Hipmunk or Kayak into Google and add PayPal. To our time traveller from 1961, however, it would be magic. You have a little glowing box, and if you tell it, I want to visit my cousin Bill wherever he is, a taxi will pull up and take you to Bill's house if he lives nearby, or a Greyhound bus station or the airport. Better hope Bill isn't visiting Nepal. It could get expensive. Smartphones aren't merely there to make your high school geography teachers weep, just as pocket calculators made maths teachers cry a generation ago. Something like 50% of smartphone users check their work email while they're on vacation. A vast majority check work email when they're away from their desk. The whole point of the desk was for many people in the 20th century that it was a fixed place of contact where co-workers or customers could reach you reliably during office hours. Our phones aren't quite up to the job of replacing the office desk yet, but with Pico projectors and more bandwidth in the pipeline, they show every sign of hitting that point within the next 5 to 10 years. Even today, a typical iOS or Android handset has about as many MIPS as a workstation circa 2001 to 2003. And it's not immediately obvious why most office workers need many more orders of magnitude more computing power than that to get the job done, at least in their pocket, as opposed to in a server farm somewhere in the cloud. We already saw a bunch of changes in office jobs come in with laptops. Hot desking isn't easy when employees are tied to a specific location by wires. Similarly, it's going in the opposite direction in some sectors. Following a spate of embarrassing laptop-left-in-taxi stories over the last few years, large chunks of the British civil service no longer use laptops. Instead, they rely on desktop PCs and wired Ethernet with biometrically secured iron key thumb drives to store employee-specific credentials. All this, of course, assumes that we still have jobs to go to. The whole question of whether a mature technosphere needs 3 or 4 billion full-time employees is an open one, as is the question of what they're all going to be doing and what we're going to be doing if it turns out the future can't deliver jobs. So that's actually a ticking time bomb in the prognostication about the future, and I'm going to tiptoe away from it. So what are the non-employee-related impact of smartphones? Most people spend most of their lives away from the desk, away from work, doing other stuff. Living, well, surfing the web for silly cat photographs or porn, trying to keep the multiple facets of their identity from colliding messily on Facebook. Forget online dating. How many teens have met their girlfriend or boyfriend's parents for the first time via Facebook? Also, checking competitors' prices from the aisle of Walmart, and texting while driving. We're still in the first decade of mass mobile internet uptake, which is coming to us on the back of these smartphones, and we still haven't seen what it really means when the internet becomes a pervasive part of the social environment, rather than something we have to specifically sit down and plug ourselves into, usually at a desk. So let me try and predict the mobile internet of 2061 and what it's going to look like. To some extent, the shape of a future depends on whether whoever provides the basic service of communication, be it fibre in the ground or wireless or optical frequencies over the air, funds their service by charging for bandwidth or charging for a fixed infrastructure cost. The latter is vastly preferable. I'm British, and I'm carrying an iPhone today that has an IQ of about 70. A full fat iPhone 4, that is, despite everything, but it's as dumb as a brick. The reason it's as dumb as a brick is that I'm using it with a SIM from a British Selco whose international roaming data rate is around $5 a megabyte. Welcome back to the internet of the early 1990s. To get around the problem, I've got a Virgin Mobile MiFi, a cellular Wi-Fi router. But it comes with an unwelcome constraint. Even the so-called unlimited tariff caps me at 2.5 gigs of data in a month. If I go over that cap, the connection will be throttled. And I could blow that cap in a couple of hours just by downloading a new software update for my laptop. Welcome to the landline broadband internet of the early 2000s. From my dumb consumer's point of view, it'd be vastly preferable to pay a higher but fixed price for infrastructure without metering or throttling. Then I could download all the OS updates or talking cat videos or whatever at will. But this is obviously less than appealing to Sprint or AT&T or whoever. They'd all much rather artificially depress demand by imposing punitive charges on heavy users, because installing new infrastructure is expensive. These two models for pricing, then, paying for the infrastructure or paying for bandwidth, imply very different network topologies. A model where bandwidth on the backhaul is capped implies lots of peer-to-peer traffic over local area networks and lots of caching, but relatively little long-haul traffic. It implies that more powerful processors are needed at the edge of a network, because offloading the job of OCRing that 50-page construction contract to the cloud means uploading 50 pages of bitmap scans, which will cost you money. You can't outsource your brains. In contrast, a model where you just rent the fibre or wireless spectrum for a fixed price implies a lot more activity in the cloud and thinner clients. And yeah, I know full well we've been chewing over the tension between business models, between thin clients and fat clients, since the early 1990s at least, if not earlier. This leaves aside a third model, that of peer-to-peer mesh networks with no actual cellcos as such, just lots of folks with cheap routers. I'm going to provisionally assume that this one is hopelessly utopian, a GNU vision of telecommunications that can't actually work on a large scale because the routing topology of such a network is going to be nightmarish, unless for a fat fibre optic cable's lurking somewhere in the background. It's kind of a shame. I'd love to see a future where no corporate behemoths have a chokehold on the internet, but humans aren't evenly distributed geographically. Our best hope for a networked future might be that the new middle-class African, Indian and Chinese populations will benefit from the kind of shiny new infrastructure that we in crumbling Europe and America can only dream of, and that eventually this goads our local infrastructure services into raising their game. Or maybe some radically disruptive new technology will come along. Open access peer-to-peer mesh networks using do-it-yourself remotely piloted drones whipped out by garage 3D printers as homebrew laser relays to span long distances and fill the fibre gap, for example. Actually, mind you, the security problems of a homebrew mesh network are enormous and gnarly and probably intractable. When any enterprising gang of scammers can set up a public router, who can you trust? Such a world is going to be either crime-ridden or pervasively encrypted and inhabited by natives who are required to be perfectly spherical cypherpunks. Just like my 80-something parents, not. So I'm going to assume there's going to be fibre in the ground at some point, run by local infrastructure providers. Now I want to divert a little and talk about storage density. I'm throwing around fairly gigantic amounts of data in this talk. Where are we going to store it all? The answer is, as Richard Feynman put it in 1959, that there's plenty of room at the bottom. Let's hypothesize a very high-density, non-volatile serial storage medium that might be manufactured using molecular nanotechnology. I call it memory diamond. It's a diamond mesh within which the state of a single data bit is encoded in each atom. Because we want it to be rigid and stable, we use a carbon-12 nucleus to represent a 0 and a carbon-13 to represent a 1. How we read and write these bits is left as an exercise for the student of mature molecular nanotechnology. But we can say with some certainty that we can store Avogadro's number of bits, roughly 6 by 10 to the 23, in 12.5 grams of diamond, or around 13,000 terabytes in an ounce. Going by the figures in a report from UCSD last year, the average worker processed or consumed 3 terabytes per year last year, and there are around 3.18 billion workers, which works out at 23 tons of memory diamond needed to store everything without compression or deduplication that was processed by all the workers on this planet in 2010. Okay. I was also going to carry on and add, at a guess, once you take out cute captioned cat videos and downloads that annoy the hell out of the MPAA, you can reduce that by at least an order of magnitude. So, yeah, I think in the long term we'll have more storage capacity than we necessarily know what to do with. Now, the real choke point is going to be wireless bandwidth, which is constrained fundamentally by the transparency of air to electromagnetic radiation. There's a reason our eyeballs operate in the visual frequencies that they do. It's because those are the frequencies up to which air is most permeable. I've seen some estimates that we may be able to punch as much as 2 terabits per second through air. Try and go much above that and we run into problems. For example, X-rays and shortwave ultraviolet are absorbed fairly efficiently by air. Infrared is absorbed fairly efficiently by water vapour. This bandwidth is spread between all the users within a given cell. The smaller the cell, the better, obviously. I've also been hearing interesting noise about the possibility of using multiple input, multiple output to get around Shannon's law, notably from a startup called OnLive, using multiple transmitters to produce constructive or destructive interference around each receiver's antenna. This may be snake oil, or there may be something there. Even so, even if MIMO works perfectly, it's hard to see how we can get past the hard limit of 2 terabits per second per wireless antenna. So, I'm going to take a wild-ass guess and postulate that the upper limit on bandwidth is 2 terabits per second per person, using a mixture of novel compression algorithms and really tiny cells. What can you do with 2 terabits per second of data per human being on the planet, let alone 2 TB per sec per wireless device, given we're already within a handful of years of having many more wireless devices than people? One thing you can trivially do with that kind of capacity is full life logging for everyone. Life logging today is in its infancy, but I'm going to finger it as, in my view, being the major disruptive technology for our civilization within 2 decades. The basic idea behind life logging is simple enough. You wear a couple of small, unobtrusive camera chips and microphones at all times. Stream their output, along with metadata such as your GPS coordinates and a time sequence, to a server somewhere. Working offline, the server performs speech-to-text on all the dialogue you utter or hear, face recognition on everyone you see, OCR on all the printed matter you look at, and this is then indexed against your time and your location. Whether it's performed in the cloud or by your smartphone, your very smartphone, is irrelevant. The resulting search technology essentially gives you a prosthetic memory. We're already used to prosthetic memory to some extent. I used Google multiple times in the preparation of this talk to retrieve specific dates and times of stuff I vaguely recalled but couldn't bring to memory directly. But Google and other search engines are a collective prosthetic memory that can only scrutinise the sunlit upper waters of the sea of human experience, the ones that have been committed to writing and then indexed. Life logging offers the promise of indexing and retrieving the unwritten and the undocumented. And this is both a huge promise and an enormous threat. Initially, I see life logging having specific niches. It's going to be a wonderful aid for people with early-stage Alzheimer, dementia, or other memory impairments, or to allow students to sleep through lectures. Police in the UK are already experimenting with real-time video recording of interactions with the public. I suspect that before long we're going to see cops required to run life-logging apps constantly when on duty, with the output locked down as evidence. And it'll eventually become mandatory for other classes of worker who are in professions where they're exposed to any risk that might result in a significant insurance claim. Surgeons, for example, or truck drivers. It won't be by force of law, it'll simply be a condition imposed by the insurance companies. Life logging into the cloud doesn't require much bandwidth in absolute terms when we're talking in terms of terabits per second. Although it'll probably take a few years to get this to take off if the Selcos succeed in imposing bandwidth caps. A few terabytes per person per year should suffice for a couple of basic video streams and full audio, plus location metadata. Multiply by 10 if you want high-definition video at a high frame rate. The additional hardware beyond what comes in a cell phone today is minimal. A couple of small webcams and microphones connected over some sort of short-range personal area network, plus software to do the offline indexing. And this is a technology which is literally poised 1 or 2 years away from mass commercial rollout, if we go this way. Now, what about the security and privacy concerns? Under what circumstance can your life log legally be accessed by third parties? How do privacy laws apply? It should be clear that anyone currently life-logging in this way takes their privacy and that of the people around them very lightly. As far as governments are concerned, they can subpoena any data they want, usually without even needing a court warrant. Projects such as the British government's Interception Modernisation Programme, essentially a comprehensive internet communications retention system mandated by government and implemented by ISPs, means that if you become a person of interest to the security services, they'd have access to everything. The prudent move currently would be to lifelog to encrypted SSDs in your personal possession, or not to do it at all. The security implications are actually enormous. If you rely on lifelogging for your memory or your ability to do your job, then the importance of that security is pushed right down Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When only elite computer scientists on ARPANET had accounts to allow them to telnet into mainframes at another site, security was just a desirable luxury and a bit of an afterthought, part of the apex of the hierarchical pyramid of needs. But when it's your actual memory or your ability to do your job, security gets to be something close to food and water and shelter. You can't actually work without it. On the upside, if done right, widespread lifelogging to cloud-based storage would have immense advantages for combating crime and preventing identity theft. Coupled with some sort of global identification system and a system of access permissions that would allow limited queries against a private citizen's lifelog, it would be very difficult to fake an alibi for a crime or to impersonate someone else. If Bill the Gangster claims he was in the pub the night of the bank robbery, you can query the cloud of lifelogs with a hash of his facial features, the GPS location of a pub, and the time he claims he was there. If one or more people's lifelogs provide a match, Bill has an alibi. Alternatively, if a whole bunch of folks saw him exiting the back of a bank with a sack labelled swag, that tells a different story. Faking up an alibi in a pervasively lifelogged civilization will be monstrously difficult, requiring the simultaneous corruption of multiple lifelogs in a manner that portrays a coherent narrative. This is a bit harder than just nobbling a witness by threatening to slash their car tyres. So, I think that the question of whether lifelogging becomes a big social issue depends partly on the nature of our pricing model for bandwidth, and also how we hammer out the security issues surrounding the idea of our sensory inputs being logged for posterity. Lifelogging isn't merely something for humans. You can already buy a collar-mounted camera for your pet dog or cat. I think it's pretty likely we're going to end up instrumenting farm animals as well, and possibly individual plants such as apple trees or grapevines. Anything of sufficient value that we don't kill it after it's fruited. Lifelogging for cars and other machines is already here. If you buy a high-end model, Bruce Sterling has been banging on about what he calls SPIMES, physical objects that have an internet presence, for years. I don't think I need to go on much on that dimension, other than to mention, sooner or later, all cars are going to be networked, able to book themselves in for preventative maintenance rather than stranding you when they break down in the middle of your travel, not to mention snitching on your acceleration and overtaking habits to your insurance company, at least until self-driving automobiles match and then exceed human driver safety. What other data sources can we import into the internet? Well, as I mentioned earlier, we're currently living through a period in genomics research that is roughly like the early 1960s in computing. In particular, there's a huge boom in new technologies for high-speed gene sequencing. Back in 1989, it was expected that the Human Genome Project would cost around $3 billion and take 2 decades. In practice, it cost a lot less, was completed well ahead of schedule, and the last 90% of the work was done in the last 18 months, thanks to the development of automated high-speed sequencers. We're now seeing a mass of disruptive technologies for high-throughput DNA sequencing hit the market, with full genome sequencing for individuals now available for around $30,000 and expected to drop to $1,000 to $3,000 within about another 2 to 3 years. This is compared with $3 billion for sequencing the first person. The technologies in question, such as DNA microarrays, also benefit from the same miniaturization cycle as semiconductors 3 to 5 decades ago. And analysis of resulting data in turn relies on the availability of cheap supercomputing clusters. To put it in perspective, the Archon X Prize for Genomics was established in 2006. It's expected to be collected within the next couple of years, and it promises $10 million to the first team that can build a device and use it to sequence 100 human genomes within 10 days or less, within certain accuracy constraints, at a recurring cost of no more than $10,000 per genome. Now, there's probably no reason to exhaustively sequence your own genome more than once. And your genome isn't the rigid determinant of your health and metabolic fate that it was believed to be in the naive pre-scientific dark ages of the late 1980s. We are, if anything, only just beginning to scope out the extent of our own ignorance of how cellular biology works. But we live within an ecosystem of other organisms. Each of us is carrying around a cargo of 1 to 3 kilograms of bacteria and other unicellular organisms, which collectively outnumber the cells of our own bodies by 1,000 to 1. They're mostly much smaller than our own cells. These are, for the most part, commensal organisms. They live in our guts and predigest our food, or they live on our skin, but they play a significant role in the functioning of our immune system. One of the most dangerous medical crises we face today is the spread of antibiotic resistance among pathogenic organisms. Lest we forget, as recently as the 1930s, fully a third of us could expect to die of a fulminating bacterial infection or of an old pandemic threat such as tuberculosis. These threats are now re-emerging in the form of, for example, multidrug-resistant TB and various other drug-resistant bacterial strains. New threats are also emerging continuously. Most members of the public don't generally realise how close to catastrophe we've come in microbial terms in the very recent past. For example, in 2006, you may remember SARS. It was a disease not unlike the common cold in its infectious virulence, but with a 15% mortality rate, as in 15% of the people infected with it died, and it spread like the cold. Only the rapid development of DNA assays for SARS, it was sequenced within 48 hours of its identification as a new virus, made it possible to build and enforce the quarantine regime that saved us from somewhere between 200 million and a billion dead. A second crisis we face is that of cancer. Cancer is almost always the emergent consequence of a malfunction within the genetic machinery of the cell that causes it to start dividing and refuse to stop. Today, 40% of the British population are expected to develop cancer at some point in their lives. With genome sequencing microarrays tending towards the price and efficiency of VLSI circuits and serious bandwidth available to upload and process the data stream they deliver, we can expect eventually to see home genome monitoring, both looking for indicators of precancerous conditions or immune disorders within our bodies, and also performing metagenomic analysis of the environment around us. It'll deliver both personal benefits, catching early signs of infectious diseases or cancer, but also, more importantly, provide health agencies with early warning of epidemics. If our metagenomic environment is routinely included in life logs, we have the holy grail of epidemiology within reach, the ability to exhaustively track the spread of pathogens and identify how they adapt to their host environment right down to the level of individual victims. Is losing your genomic privacy an excessive price to pay for surviving cancer and avoiding plague? Is compromising your sensory privacy through life logging a reasonable price to pay for preventing malicious impersonation and apprehending criminals? Is letting your insurance company know exactly how you steer and hit the gas and brake pedals and where you drive an acceptable price to pay for cheaper insurance? Each of these three examples are examples of situations where personal privacy may be invaded, and where there exists a strong argument for doing so in the name of a common good, for preventing epidemics, crime, and traffic accidents. They differ fundamentally from the currently familiar arguments for invasion of our data privacy by law enforcement, for example, to read our email or look for evidence of copyright violation. Reading our email involves our public and private speech, and looking for wares involves our public and private assertion of intellectual property rights. But eavesdropping on our metagenomic environment and on our sensory environment impinges directly on our identity as human beings. I don't mean our identities in the conventional information security context, which is basically access credentials to information resources and computers. I mean our actual identities as physically distinct humans. We use the term identity theft today to talk about theft of access credentials. But in the future, identity theft may mean something radically more drastic. If we take a reductionist view of human nature, which I'm inclined to do, our metagenomic context, not just our own genome and proteome, but the genome of our gut flora and fauna and the organisms we coexist with, and our sensory inputs, actually define who we are, at least from the outside. And that's not a whole lot of data to capture, if you look at it in the context of 2 terabits per second of bandwidth per person. Assume a human life expectancy of a century, and 1 terabit per second of data to log everything about that person, and you can capture a human existence in roughly 3.15 by 10 to the 21 bits, or about 65 milligrams of memory diamond, unless I've dropped 3 orders of magnitude somewhere. With life logging and other forms of ubiquitous computing mediated by wireless broadband, securing our personal data will become as important to individuals as securing our physical bodies. If somebody has compromised your life log, forget about just changing your passwords and your credit card. They have access to everything, including all your shared secrets, all your passwords, all your relationships with other people, all your dirty little secrets, everything. Unfortunately, securing this information, important as it may be, isn't something we can expect the general public to become security professionals. Well, we can't expect the general public to become security professionals any more than we can expect them to become judo black belts or expert marksmen. Security is going to be a perpetual, ongoing problem. Moreover, right now we have the luxury of a short history. The World Wide Web is just 20 years old this week. The internet is younger than I am. The shifting sands of software obsolescence have, for the most part, buried our ancient learning mistakes. Who remembers GeoCities today? Nor is there much to be gained by black hat brute force decrypting a bunch of 10-year-old credit card accounts. They're mostly different numbers now. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to be like that in the future. We can expect the pace of innovation to slow drastically once we can no longer count on routinely more powerful computing hardware or faster network connections coming along every 18 months or so. Some forms of personal data, however, medical records, for example, or land title deeds, need to remain accessible over periods of decades to centuries. Life logs will be similar. If you want at age 90 to recall events that happened to you at age 9, then you need a stable platform for storing your memory. And it needs to be one that isn't trivially crackable in less than 81 years and counting. So robustness and durability are going to be at a premium in the future, even if we don't get those breakthroughs in life extension medicine that will allow you to mock me for getting it wrong in 2561. We're moving towards an age when we may have enough bandwidth to capture pretty much the totality of a human lifespan, everything except for what's going on inside our skulls. Storing and indexing the data from such life logging is, if not trivial, doable. The average human being utters around 5,000 words a day and probably reads less than 50,000. These aren't impossible speech-to-text and OCR targets, even with today's equipment. And while there's plausible reasons we might not be able to assert the overriding importance of personal privacy in such data, it's also clear that a complete transcript of every word you ever utter in your life, with accompanying visuals and smell and haptic and locational metadata, is of enormous value. So, from all this, I've got a conclusion, and unfortunately it's a bit of a dismal one. It's nearly impossible to underestimate the political significance of information security on the Internet of the future. Rather than our credentials and our secrets being at risk, our credit card and accounts and access to our email, our actual memories and sense of self may be vulnerable to tampering by a sufficiently deft attacker. From being an afterthought or a luxury, relevant only to a handful of computer scientists in the 1970s, information security is being inexorably pushed down the pyramid of needs until it's important to all of us. As important as water or shelter. Because it's no longer about our property, physical or intellectual, or about authentication. It's about our actual identity as people. And that's where I'm going to end. Are there any questions?
Yeah, questions can come up to the microphone. Well, thanks, Charlie. That was great. I really like that. My name is Rick Farrow, by the way. One thing, when you were talking about life logging, where I wanted those cameras and microphones were in the offices of politicians when they're making deals. I would surely have loved to see the discussions between, say, John Boehner and Obama in the White House when they discuss a deal that involves only cuts and no taxes. You know, things like that. I would love to be able to even watch the local, you know, I live in an area that's owned largely by the U.S. government through the Forest Service, which is funny because I live in the desert. And in past years, huge chunks of this desert would change hands sort of mysteriously, and then the forest ranger would be driving a nice SUV. And so, so somebody could develop this land, but, you know, you couldn't really prove that there was a bribe paid there. And so I'd really like to hear what you have to say about life logging and how that might deal with, if that would ever make its way into the political space.
The impact on politics is going to be explosive and very, very messy. Back in 1995, I think, a couple of British journalists with an interest in the internet were increasingly annoyed at the proliferation of closed-circuit TV cameras around London. And given where they lived, one of them decided to put a webcam in his living room window overlooking the front door of the then Home Secretary. He got a visit from the police within 12 hours of it going live. Certain representations were made to him, as a result of which it disappeared very rapidly. There is a fundamental asymmetry in relationships between individuals and either corporations or the state. And I think that people with privilege of office or privilege of money will fight tooth and nail to keep their privacy intact and keep exemption from it. I believe David Brin had a lot to say about this from the 1990s, in particular a book titled The Open Society, The Transparent Society, which he goes into this at some length. I'm afraid to say I think he's a bit of an optimist. There is a countervailing vision of how bad things could get in fictionalized in Verna Vinge's novel A Deepness in the Sky, in which he explores the idea of a total panopticon surveillance society and just how bad it could get. It's a real can of worms. We do urgently need more political accountability. A problem we've got, though, is we're living in a complex world. Politics has largely been reduced to soundbite, at least in public, because actually understanding the issues under discussion is a matter for whole teams working long term. Our politicians are, to some extent, front men for teams. I don't know how this is going to play out. I do suspect that the Arab Spring is one of the first symptoms of a rebalancing, as it were, between the public and private spheres, mediated by mass communications and, indeed, smartphones. But we've barely seen the beginning of it. One thing I would like to add is it's fairly widely believed that the current rioting all over England is being mediated by BlackBerry Messenger.
Very good. Yeah.